This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B, and thank you for joining me. In the next 60 minutes, I'm going to give you three very different topics, and I don't want you to miss one second. Later in the show, my interview with author Rebecca Mackay, who's written a powerful novel of friendship and redemption in the face of tragedy. This is among the first novels to chronicle the AIDS epidemic from its initial outbreak to the present. Rebecca has pointed the spotlight on a time that many of us lost dear friends. But because of those losses, we've tended to shy away from exploring the pain and the emotions of those early days of the AIDS crisis. Rebecca Mackay joins me to talk about The Great Believers. That's later in the show. Also coming up, Kajia Pantsa, who will talk about her new book, The Finnish Way. Now, this is an engaging and practical guided tour of the simple and natural-inspired ways that the Finns stay happy and healthy. First, we revisit my interview with Chloe Benjamin. Now, about a week or so ago, late-night talk show host Jimmy Fallon introduced The Tonight Show's first-ever book club and included The Immortalists, the new brilliant novel by Chloe Benjamin. Now, since then, a number of listeners have requested to hear my conversation with Chloe again. "Is the book that good?" asked Lanny. And Meredith wrote and said, "I don't remember you saying The Immortalists was a light read." Little sarcasm there. "Seems a little confusion when a book we've raved on about is selected by the least cerebral of late-night comedians." So to set the record straight, here then is my conversation with Chloe Benjamin on The Immortalists. Would you like to know when you're going to die? Think about that for a moment. Now, this is the premise of a new, brilliant novel from Chloe Benjamin. The title, The Immortalists. Chloe Benjamin, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much. I am absolutely thrilled to be here.
Your book has kept me talking about it since I read it about a week ago. And I'm one of these people, when I pick a book up that I like, I start reading and then I don't stop. I just keep on. And I sort of, everything else has to stop. And yours was one of those books. And I also should just say this to you. I just wish that we had a lot more time to talk. Like me, your time is kind of restricted. So let's get it underway, shall we? Immortalists. The Gold Children, Daniel, Clara, Simon, and Vara. From the very first page of The Immortalists, you give us insights into who these children are and who they're going to be. And the story opens in 1969 in New York's Lower East Side. And the kids hear about a mystical woman who's able to tell everyone the day they'll die. Goodness, what an interesting idea. Tell me about how this all came to be.
Well, I love your enthusiasm, first of all. It's such a treat for me. This came to be because of my own neuroses. I am somebody who has always struggled with uncertainty and not knowing. And of course, those conditions are so core to human life. And so I thought, well, what if you could know the greatest unknown of all, which is, you know, how long you have in the world up at the front of it. And would that be a blessing or a curse?
Now, you tell us, of course, in the book when they do die. And I've been having this struggle about whether I should say, give the ages or not. And I decided, no, I'm not going to, because I want my listeners to become readers and so they can find out for themselves.
Oh, I think that that's a good way to go. I too struggled with, how much information I give people as they're reading the book. There's some of the siblings, you know, their dates pretty early, yeah. And then others you don't find out until some time has passed.
And some of them, Simon, for instance, you kind of get a clue because of what happens. You kind of get a clue. Maybe he might die kind of young. Can you talk about Simon?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's giving away too much to say that Simon knows he's gay. You find this out in the first 30 pages or so.
Actually, can I stop you? I think you find out in the first minute that you describe him, because there's something that you say, and I don't know if this was deliberate or not. You talk about his legs.
Oh, or I think, are you thinking of when he's noticing another man's
legs? Yes, that's right. Excuse me. He's noticing another man's legs. Yes, exactly. Yes, 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 yes. Yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And so he, you know, Simon is an athlete. He's a runner. He's somebody who girls are drawn to, but he's not been drawn to them. And he's given a prophecy that shakes him up. And so he thinks, well, maybe I should start now living the life that I want for myself. And so at 16, he decides to run away from home, and he goes to San Francisco, where there's a burgeoning gay rights movement and more acceptance. And so his section picks up in 78, after it's about 9 years after that first scene of the siblings going to see the fortune teller.
Yeah.
And Simon is off for something new.
Now, you describe Simon, and they're just going to focus in on this for a moment, and his lifestyle in San Francisco, a time and a place that you didn't go through yourself. How did you get the information? What sort of gave you all those sort of great details that you tell us?
Yeah, well, it was really important to me to write Simon's section, all of the books, certainly, with integrity, especially when it covered experiences that I hadn't lived through myself. I do share some DNA that might surprise people with Simon's section. I grew up in San Francisco, and I also grew up with gay parents. So while I certainly wasn't a gay man in the 70s or 80s, I felt a deep connection to that community. But in order to research, I did a lot of archival research. I looked at footage and newspapers from the time. I watched documentaries. I read nonfiction. I did interviews. I looked at maps, really everything that you can imagine to try to situate myself in that time.
You do it very well. And for somebody that was in San Francisco at that time and amongst other places, it conjured up lots of memories for me. You do it very well with all the children, all the gold children. But before we get to talking more about them, I just want to talk about the parents, Saul and Gertie. Can you just talk about their parents for a moment?
Yeah, so Saul and Gertie are both the children of immigrants, Jews who have come over through Ellis Island from Eastern Europe to escape discrimination. And so they both feel more bound to conventionality, I think, than their children do. Like a lot of children of immigrants, they feel a great weight on their shoulders to maintain their family's place in this somewhat new world. And at the same time, though, I wanted to give them their own personhood. I think Gertie in particular, in some ways, she's an archetypal Jewish mother. Yeah. But in others, she has her own humanity. And that was really important to me.
We're talking to Chloe Benjamin, the author of a brand new book, a must read. It's called The Immortalist. I want to talk to you about religion, because I think it comes into your book all the way through your book. And you just talked about their Jewish heritage. And I just want to throw this in before we get going on this. And if you don't mind me sharing this, I grew up in a very culturally mixed neighborhood in South London. And my family didn't subscribe to any religion. But my father was fascinated by our Jewish neighbors. And he made good friends with them, so he would often get invited to bar mitzvahs and weddings and, I guess, funerals. And my dad loved going to temple. And so as he got older, on Saturdays, he would go along with the other fathers to temple. And then afterwards, he loved this. He would stand outside just chattering, just having a great old conversation. It was important to me just in my growing up, just hearing what he had to say about somebody else's and some other community's religion, even though we weren't religious. And I wondered about your religion and how that played a part in your book.
That's such an interesting story. Thank you for sharing it with me. I can relate in that. I think I've always felt like a little bit of an outsider and a little bit of an insider in religion. And I think that vantage point makes you curious and maybe able to see things that people for whom that religion is really native take for granted. I grew up with two religions. My mom's side of the family is Episcopalian. Oh, my grandfather was actually a minister.
Oh.
And my dad's side of the family is Jewish. Yeah. And the content in the book about, in particular, Saul's family is very much pulled from my father's family's history. My great-grandfather was a tailor. He owned his own business and, you know, came through Ellis Island, along with his parents some years before. So I think I've always been curious about both religions. And I was especially curious about Judaism because, it wasn't, I mean, my mom had my brother and I go to Sunday school when we were young, but after my parents divorced, my dad remarried, a Jewish spiritual director.
Oh.
And so, my dad himself is pretty, sorry, that's my cat in the background.
It's okay.
My dad himself is pretty much an atheist, but when Ellen came along, she really brought religion into our lives. And so sort of like your father, I found myself so curious about the rituals and the language and the holidays.
You know, it's interesting because I think this is why I mentioned it, because my father was more fascinated by some of the rituals, but also it was the language and it was the conversations. It was the conversations that he had with the other fathers outside of the synagogue. They would stand there just chattering, and the conversations went in all kinds of directions, which made me think of your book and made me think of the Golds. So now let's turn to the children. We talked about Simon. You describe so well the different decades, what, four decades that we go through. Did you have, as you're putting the book together, did you have a favorite character?
You know, I feel so guilty saying a favorite character because I do feel like they're all my children.
Yeah.
But I really do love them all. I think I have a soft spot for Clara, I have to say. I just think she's cool and I want to be friends with her.
Yeah. I thought the same thing, and I thought that's what you were going to say.
Clear? It's, sometimes that can be annoying when you can tell that a writer just adores this particular character and like they, you know, they sort of coddle them, but she didn't get much coddling.
Now, because you sort of kind of like Clara just a little bit more, did you write her differently to the way you wrote the others?
I'd be curious to hear what you think. Like, I didn't think I did, but what made you think that she was probably my answer to that question?
There was just something about the way, like at the very beginning, you don't mind sort of giving away stuff about Clara that you seem to keep sort of like a little bit more guarded from some of the other characters.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, maybe. I also think that I knew more about her and Simon at the outset. They were the siblings who were clearest to me. And I sometimes wonder, is that why I started with them? I didn't necessarily have some grand plan to go from youngest to oldest, you know, in the order of the narrative. But yeah, that is true. There is more information given about her early on.
Yeah. The Immortalist is the title of the book. It's the brand new novel from Chloe Benjamin. Death haunts us all, and at some point more explicitly than at other times. What was the starting point for you in writing the book?
Well, I think, like I said, it was that emotional trigger, frankly. Yeah. I've always struggled with mortality, and I kind of don't understand how some people are able to not think about it. So that combination of denial and ignorance, which I think many of us, myself included, lean into until we have to face our mortality, combined with a sort of tendency toward anxiety in me and an awareness of that ignorance, if that makes sense. Those were some of the things floating around that made this book feel like the one I had to write.
Now, there's one question I have to ask you, and it haunted me throughout your book. Did the fortune teller tell the truth?
Oh, well, you know, that is the question, and I don't mean to be coy, but I don't know myself, and I don't know myself because I think if I had one idea, you know, one way or the other, I wouldn't have been able to write the book with an openness to a lot of different possibilities, and it probably wouldn't have held my attention. So I actually like to hear what I debated in my own mind. What do you think? Did she have this power, or, you know, was what happened self-fulfilling?
You know, as I read the book, Chloe, I think maybe it was when I got to, let me think, it was at one point when I thought, oh gosh, yes, of course she was telling the truth. But at the beginning, the very beginning when she tells Clara, I didn't believe her. I was willing myself not to believe her. So I guess I'm sort of sitting on the fence like you are a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. Well, you know, the thing I tend to lean into is the gray area, and I think it's always a both and.
Yeah.
You know, I think in life things are so rarely one way or the other, and so I tend to think that she did have some incredible power of perception, but also there's a moment in that initial scene with Varya where, you know, she says character is fate. And so I also like the idea that maybe if the siblings had changed, things would have gone differently for them.
Yes.
And ironically, I think Varya changes the most in her section.
Right. Yes. You know, there's something I should point out to you. And I mean, it's possibly that this has been pointed out to you before, but when I was typing, I type notes for myself when I'm reading a book, just so I can remember what I'm going to talk about. And I typed in The Immortalists. And of course, my spell check on my computer didn't like that word, and it kept changing it for me. Has anybody else told you that? The Immortalists in spell check, it kind of doesn't like it.
Oh, yeah, it goes to The Immoralists, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I've gotten The Immoralists quite a bit. Sometimes in the title of reviews, it'll be like, The Immoralists, you know, in huge letters, the new book from Chloe Benjamin, and my publicist has to drop a line and say, oh, I think that was the wrong title. I did see this one review, and it was a good review, and I was like, wait, is this for my book? You know, you're sort of out of body when you're seeing a review for the first time.
Right.
But yeah, I could get into that title. I think that expresses a certain something from the book.
Yeah. Did you, when you were thinking the title, did the title come early, or did you already have it? So tell me about the title.
It came early, and thank God for it, because I really struggle with titles. I'm not being self-deprecating when I say this was pretty much the first good title I've ever thought of. The title for my first book, my editor thought of it, and I've always had a really hard time with them. But I find that when a title comes to me early, it's usually a good one, and it's such a gift because then I can kind of use that like a North Star that I'm writing toward.
Yeah, I love the family tree on the cover of the book. I very nice. Looks very good.
Oh, that's nice. And have you seen the UK version?
I have not, no, but I will look it up. What's
Oh,
that?
Yes. I'd be curious to hear what you think, and if you think, you know, it's just so interesting how different markets interpret
Yes. Last question for you, Chloe. And I've got to ask you this. Do you want to know when you're going to die?
Well, I always say that I would, but only if it were good news. So therein kind of lies the paradox, because, of course, you couldn't know that ahead of time. So, right. No, I would be too, you know, I wish I could say I was the kind of person who would, like, use it as motivation, but I think I would just be crying at home in my pajamas. Would you want to?
You know, I knew that you were going to ask me that, and I had to think about this. And I think, just like you, no, I don't want to know. Yet at the same time, I have this sort of, it would be like winning the lottery. It would be like I kind of know what I would do with the money, or do I?
I don't think we know exactly how we would respond until we're faced with that kind of knowledge.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I'm driving my son to school this morning, and I got a teenage son, and he's, you know, he's a teenager, so he's like getting conversation out of a teenage boy in the early in the morning, at 7 o'clock in the morning, is just not very, you know, it doesn't work. And I'm thinking about my interview that I have with you today, and I'm thinking about, reflecting on asking you that question as I have my son just sort of lollygagging in the seat next to me. And of course, it changes when you look at your child. You start to think different thoughts. So it's a terrific book. It's called The Immortalists. Chloe Benjamin has been our guest. Chloe, thank you so very much for writing a terrific book, and thank you for being a guest at Life Elsewhere.
Oh, thank you so much for your engagement with it. That's such an honor to me. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Still to come in the show, my interview with Rebecca Mackay on her moving and compelling new novel, The Great Believers. Now, this is among the first novels to chronicle the AIDS epidemic from its initial outbreak to the present. But now we're going to find out about The Finnish Way, an engaging and practical guided tour of the simple and nature-inspired ways that Finns stay happy and healthy, with author Katja Pantsa, right after this.
You are listening to Life Elsewhere with Norman B. You can learn more about this program at lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
The book is called The Finnish Way. The subtitle: Finding Courage, Wellness, and Happiness Through the Power of Sisu. And the author is Katja Pantsa. Katja, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, we have just a little bit of a delay, which is not going to be too much of a problem, but I hope that you can hear me fine.
I can hear you fine.
Good. All right.
Hopefully you can hear me fine, too.
I can hear you fine. So, I'm going to start off by telling you, when this book was sent to me, and I looked at the cover and read the subtitle, and I'm going to be totally honest with you, I was a little bit, it was a little bit daunting for me, because I thought, oh no, not another book that's going to tell me how to be healthy.
I understand.
but of course, I got to reading your book, and it's a thoroughly enjoyable read. You give me an insight into how this book came about, and I'd like you to just tell my listeners, in your own words, how this book came about, The Finnish Way.
Sure, I'd love to. Well, essentially, I grew up in North America, in Canada, and with some stints along the way, went to school in England and lived in New Zealand. And had a very good life in Canada. Canada is a wonderful place. And I moved to Finland. It was meant to only be temporary, to take a job. And what happened was I gradually noticed that I was just feeling a lot better physically and mentally. And that the lifestyle somehow just seemed so much more manageable. I started cycling to work year-round, even when it's like minus 10, minus 20 Celsius. I took up this practice of winter swimming, which is when you go and you actually take a dip in water that's about plus 2, plus 4 degrees. I can tell you a little bit more about why it feels so great, because it does sound like a very crazy thing to do. But there is actually some research and some background into how it sets off the happy hormones and all that.
Yeah.
I started eating the Nordic diet, and by that, it's not any special diet, but I just started eating kind of a more sensible, regular diet. Or again, I shouldn't use the word diet, but, you know, more vegetables and just more proper food, and less of the kind of the all kinds of different diets and exercise programs that in North America somehow it had seemed much more complicated, you know, this notion of well-being and exercise and diet. And did all of these different things started looking really around at how people live and what they do and, you know, their very close relationship to nature and how, you know, they forage with great enthusiasm for berries and mushrooms and just do a lot of things that it felt as though the lifestyle was just simpler and sensibler. Of course, you can't compare cities and you know, in that regard, Helsinki has a lot of green space. It's surrounded by water. So, you know, you have the option every day of going for a dip if you choose. You don't need to travel far. But it was really this realization of all of these great ideas and ways of living that I thought, gosh, this is really worth sharing, because I know so many people who really struggle with, you know, finding a diet or a special exercise program or even the functionality of their life. They spend several hours a day in a car. And of course, that happens in Finland too. I'm not saying that everybody cycles or walks to work, but it just seemed to me that there were a lot of people who their lifestyle was you know, functional. It was simple. It was sensible. And there was a lot of stuff here. You know, as a journalist, I thought this is really worth sharing because many of the things in the book are, I think, can be done anywhere. Not all of them, because it depends where you live. It may not be safe to cycle, for example, or they may not be cycling lanes. But, you know, this idea of kind of simplifying and also this notion of sisu, this special Finnish fortitude that, you know, you sort of don't always take the easy way out, you know, just because it's snowing and it's minus 10, you can still bike.
Yes.
You can still, you know, head out for a long walk.
Well, I'm so glad. I'm so glad that you did share with us and wrote the book, The Finnish Way, because as I said at the very beginning, when I first saw the book, it was kind of daunting because I thought it was going to be yet another book chastising me to be more healthy. I think I'm pretty healthy. I go to the gym pretty regularly, at least 5 times a week. I eat pretty healthily. But after reading your book, I just thought to myself, you know, gosh, I think I'd like to move to Finland because it just seems just what a great way of life. Katja, tell me about these going into the water in such cold. I mean, describe to me again about taking those dips into the water every day. How cold is it?
Yeah, well, in the wintertime, it can be, you know, like +2 degrees Celsius, which is very cold.
Yeah.
But it also, you know, if it's not a very warm summer, the water might be like 15 degrees and you can still get some of the same benefits. But essentially what struck me, I mean, Finns are not known as the sort of smiliest, small talkiest people.
Yeah.
And when I discovered winter swimming, you know, I was like, there's got to be something in this because there's these people coming out of the water and they're just beaming and they're happy and they're social. And, you know, there's just doesn't seem to be a negative person anywhere in sight. So I tried it just thinking, you know, as a journalist, you have to try everything. And I had heard about this practice and seen it, you know, over the years I had seen people doing it because there's so many spots that you can do it, not only in Finland or throughout Finland, but in Helsinki, right in the capital. And initially when I tried it, I just thought, this is insane. I mean, it's a cold, dark, snowy, wintry night. I'm standing on a dock in my bathing suit, wearing a wool hat. The idea is you want to preserve your body heat.
Yes.
You know, with the wool hat. You know, I have these rubber kind of slippers and gloves on that my friend has lent me because the extremities, of course, get very cold quickly. And of course, if you've never done winter swimming before, it really is a shock to the system.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, okay, I'll try this. And then I went in and it literally hurt. I mean, it felt like pins pricking.
Ooh.
You know, a million pins pricking the skin. And then, you know, I climbed out of the water and you know, at that moment had thought, okay, well, that was an interesting experience, you know, and that was that. But what actually happened was, as I was walking back to the building that housed the sauna and the showers, I started to feel this kind of tingling feeling all over, like I'd just been to a massage or something.
Oh my. Yeah.
But also this kind of feeling of euphoria and kind of joy. And I went, wait a minute, now this is interesting. And now I understand why people do this.
Yes.
And then from there, I quickly became, I mean, seriously addicted. I joined the club, which conveniently is very close to where I live, because that also is, you know, part of the functional Nordic lifestyle. And I probably wouldn't do it every day if I had to drive an hour to get to a winter swimming spot. You know, it would make it much more difficult. And then I started doing it, and increasing my kind of resistance, and going, sometimes I'll go for 4 or 5 dips and I'll be in the water for maybe a minute or two. And then I'll have a sauna in between. And after you've done that, you just feel fabulous.
You know,
and there is, of course,
there's
a whole body of research about why that is.
Yeah. There's one thing that comes through in your book, and very quickly, I want to tell you, and that is, everything that you're doing, you're, along the way, it seems to me that you're seeing other people being happy. And I'm just wondering whether that's probably part of what happens, is that you see other people being exuberant and happy, and it makes you feel happy. It makes you feel good. Unfortunately, Katja, we really don't have much more time. We got to wrap it up because you have another interview. It really is a fabulous book, The Finnish Way by Katja Panza. Thank you for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
The AIDS epidemic in Chicago is the background to a powerful new novel, The Great Believers. I'll talk with the author, Rebecca Mackay, right after this.
This is Life Elsewhere, hosted by Norman B. We would like to know what you think of our program. Send your comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.
Sign for what's been, sign.
The book is called The Great Believers. It's by Rebecca Mackay. Rebecca, hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Life Elsewhere. Okay, this is going to be probably one of the most difficult interviews I think I've ever done. Let me explain why. The beginning of your book, it's the opening, is a memorial for Nico, one of the what's the dead character in the book, and who's died of AIDS. And just the very first few pages, gosh, I've been there, Rebecca.
Yeah.
And it touched me in such a way that I was like, oh my goodness, I'm not going to be able to finish this. I'm not going to be able to get through it. Of course I did, and thoroughly enjoyed the book. But I just wanted to set it up and let you know just how much I think this book is going to touch not just me, but other people that were there, not necessarily in Chicago, where your book is set, part of your book anyway, but just at that time in the 80s. Now, after my long, rambling, sort of emotional introduction, let me hand it over to you so you can tell my listeners, just in your words, what The Great Believers is about.
I'll do that, but thank you for saying that. I really appreciate that. And maybe before I talk about it, I'll just say that I think the only, you know, I was only able to write this book because I spoke so much to people who were there, who were, you know, intimately involved in that time, in that place, in the AIDS crisis. So, you know, what you're feeling there is I think all of their voices coming through. And yeah. So it makes me very happy to hear that. The Great Believers is, it starts in 1985, Chicago, and we're following one main character, Yale Tishman. And as you said, it starts with the memorial of his first close friend to die of AIDS. And it follows Yale for the next 7 years as his life both falls apart and takes on much greater meaning. And then meanwhile, every other chapter, although they're shorter, is set in 2015 Paris, where a woman named Fiona is. It was her brother who died in the beginning, her brother Nico. And she's in Paris to track down her estranged daughter. But because of a variety of circumstances and people who resurface for her in Paris, she's also forced for the first time really to really confront and come to terms with the traumas of 30 years past.
Mm. As I said, it's a wonderful book. It is a terrific read. I want to go to the beginning, not the beginning of the book, but the beginning for you, how this came about, Rebecca, because this is such a big subject and you tackle it so incredibly well. And once again, I'm going to keep touching on this. It's such a touching, emotional book. But I'm just wondering, as I'm getting through the book, what made Rebecca Mackay write this book?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, going way back, I mean, here's, you know, what is, you know, certainly apparent to anyone who Googles me. You know, I was 7 years old when this book starts, and I'm a straight woman. So I was not there. This is not personal experience. I have many close friends in the LGBTQ community now, and including friends with HIV, but wasn't there, you know, was not hanging around in this area of town in the 80s. For me, it's something that I've always, even as a kid, always had my ears peeled for. It would come on the news, stay home sick from school, and there's a, you know, daytime talk show about it, and I was just, you know, there staring at the TV for whatever reason. It just seemed, you know, which I would say it is, seemed to me to be one of the most important things that had ever happened. And, you know, kids don't have all those filters of, well, that's happening to those people over there for some reason.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I instantly, I think, got as a kid how huge this was. That said, you know, I've written a bit about AIDS before. I had one short story in my short story collection that was set in New York about the AIDS crisis. When I set out to write this novel, I didn't know that it was going to be about AIDS. I really started with this character who's still in the book, who was an artist's model in 1920s Paris. And it was really going to be her story, but at the end of her life, which I figured couldn't be much past the 1980s, and her relationship with some kind of art guy who she was going to be giving her remaining sketches to. And because I figured I had an art guy in the 80s, I thought, okay, well, so I can write about this thing I've always been, you know, really interested in. Maybe AIDS will be a subplot of some kind. Mm. But as I started writing and as I started my research about Chicago specifically in the 80s, I found that so compelling and so urgent that the gravity of the story really shifted over. And this artist model is still there, but she's the subplot.
Right.
And I really wanted to look head on at AIDS.
What I do like so much about your book is how you incorporate the subplots and you take us in different directions. The whole book is just a terrific read. I've got a question for you, Rebecca. I'm talking to Rebecca Mackay. The book is called The Great Believers. What kept coming up to me in reading your book, and this, I think, is a question which I probably would ask perhaps anyway if I'm thinking about AIDS, and that is, do we say crisis or do we say epidemic, or what's the correct vernacular there?
That's a great question. You know, I think that... I might not be the right one to answer that question. And at the time, you know, part of the reason is, I'll tell you, you know, I'm largely writing about the 1980s. And for that reason, my vocabulary, my medical knowledge, my thinking about many things, I needed to halt it at a certain point in time. Although we're also in 2015, at that point, although she's looking back, it's much less about the AIDS crisis. So it's funny, although, you know, I'm certainly up to date on some of the statistics of how many people, you know, worldwide are living with AIDS, things like that now that I think are important to talk about. But when we get into, you know, the vocabulary of things, you know, things like that, and my knowledge stops around 1987.
Yes.
even to the point where, you know, I kept having the problem where, as I researched, if I looked up things online, all of the medical information was too recent, which is good. You want current medical information online.
Sure.
But what I did eventually was I went out and I found at a used bookstore, I found for 5 cents, because no one in their right mind would want this, a 1987 guide to living with HIV that was put out by Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
Because I needed that to be the end point of my knowledge.
Yes.
And I couldn't know anything that wasn't in the book. I'm unfortunately, you know, out of date on that. And I should figure that out as I talk about it, whether epidemic or crisis is, you know, a more helpful word.
Well, thank you for explaining
go
that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you about writing the book and with the subject of AIDS. Because so much has been written, and as you say, you go back in time and find this book, which was written at the time, and it took me back, Rebecca, it took me back to how we understood AIDS and HIV at the time, and the language that we used. I love the way that you've written the book, and I want to talk just in a moment about language and dialogue, But there's a question that I have to ask you, and that is, because so much has been written, because we now seem to think that we have such a lot of information, was it difficult for you when you decided to put this book together and you're starting to delve in to the problem of AIDS and people dying of AIDS? Was there a fear that you might sort of go off in a direction that you might get criticized for?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in several different ways. You know, on the one hand, I have this, you know, tremendous burden of getting it right.
Yeah.
And not just getting it right, you know, not only factually on the granular level of, you know, if I mention a restaurant, that restaurant better have been open that year,
yeah.
You know, but emotionally and tonally. And in that sense, you know, I was tremendously helped by the one-on-one interviews that I was able to do. I interviewed a lot of people, and I went back and I read a lot of gay weeklies from the 80s. And like I said, you know, I'm limiting my reading to the 80s when I'm researching. And I also had many of those same people who had been resources for me in the writing of the book. They read the book once it was done and were calling me out. I asked them, you know, I said, tell me anything that's not exactly right. The funniest thing someone called me out on was, he said, I don't think that in 1985 you could have walked in that direction at that time of night and gotten a cheeseburger.
Right.
I was like, okay, I'll change it. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are still places I've misstepped, but it's not for lack of trying. So, you know, I was concerned about that. I was also concerned about, you know, people who might simply be upset that as an outsider, I had written this story, that I'm, you know, in some way appropriating this narrative or speaking for other people. I think that, part of that is taken care of if you do a good enough job. I think people, you know, people are pretty fair-minded if you've done it well. It's when you do it badly they, you know, really take issue. But I also thought, you know, I wouldn't have published it if I hadn't been able to really justify it to myself. And ultimately, I do feel like, first of all, the way publishing works, the more successful my book is, the more likely a publisher is to put money behind a similar project a year from now, another book about HIV AIDS, another LGBTQ story, or ideally an LGBTQ voice that's doing literary fiction for a general audience, not a niche audience. The understanding that, which is a relatively new understanding, that people in the general public, your aunt's book club, everyone, that they might be interested in this stuff. And also that, you know, now as I promote this book, as I write essays about this book, et cetera, that I have a chance to direct people to first person accounts, to nonfiction accounts, and that hopefully the book itself, you know, even if it is the first thing someone's read about AIDS, that it won't be the last thing, that it will lead them to more reading.
I love that. One of the things that I think came to my attention in reading your book and when I finished your book, and this is a personal observation, is that it took me back. It took me to when I first discovered that a friend of mine was dying, and then, of course, it's horrible. But what it did for me was made me realize that for so long I had closed the door. I had stopped thinking about it because so many of my friends had died. And that your book helped me to sort of not relive, but to sort of open the door again. And one of the things that you do, Rebecca, so incredibly well in The Great Believers is dialogue. And you mentioned another word earlier on. You said tonality. The tone that you use is spot on in that, particularly in that opening scene. It's almost like I was there, but I'm wondering how much you've listened. I mean, obviously you did your research, it's clear, but just the dialogue, just those nuances of how people speak together, particularly gay men at that particular time. Just talk to me about that, if you wouldn't mind.
I will. Here's what I'll say. I think that for every writer, there are some things that come instinctively and other things that are blood, sweat, and tears. And there is plenty of writing that for me is just torturous labor and I have to do it again and again. But one of the things that is full instinct for me is dialogue. That is, you know, that's something that I certainly I'll edit a little bit as I go, but it's one of the things that comes first to me. And honestly, here's what I think it is. Everyone in my family, if they're not a writer, is a musician.
Oh.
And my parents were both linguistics professors, both of them, which I think is the perfect marriage, actually, of music and language. And, you know, they both speak like 11 languages.
Oh my.
So there's just something there that I think that there's that idea of the ear, right?
Yeah.
My sister came out of that. Those, you know, but there are two of us that have these linguistics professor parents. My sister is a musician. I'm a writer. So that is one of the few things that for me is just kind of like, it's already there when I sit down to write. Whereas other things like describing characters physically or, you know, editing for plot,
yeah,
those are things that I've had to learn, things that I struggle with in draft after draft.
Something else, which is one of the things that I pick up when I read the fiction, I'm always curious about names, how authors come up with names. And sometimes they work, and sometimes it seems like it's been just a little bit sort of, I don't know, pushed a little too. But in your case, Yael Tishman, yeah, it works. Nico, yeah, it works. Fiona, yeah, I these are believable. These are believable. I just would like to know, Rebecca, for you, Was it easy, or just talk to me about the names of the characters?
I do think a lot about names, and it, especially in a very populated novel where the majority, by far, of the characters are men of around the same age. You know, you need names, you know, with apologies to the Daves and Steves of the world, I couldn't name them things like Dave and Steve,
right,
because you
yeah.
never tell them apart,
yeah.
right? I remember, I must have been on a book tour or some book travel, because I remember being in a hotel room early on working on the book and just taking out a pad of paper and writing down kind of every man's name that I could think of to see if they would suggest anything. And somehow Yael came out in that list. And later I had to come up with a backstory of why on earth he'd be named this.
Yes.
Which I do get in there into the book. So some of them, you know, from the very beginning, I had their name, it stuck with them. Others, I changed their name multiple times as it didn't feel quite right, or as I realized that I had two names that were too similar to each other. Or sometimes as I combined characters, sometimes you have, you know, you're realizing that you have two different characters in two different parts of the novel, and gosh, they should probably just be the same person. And then you have to debate which name that combined person gets. But I love thinking about it. I think I asked my mother for my first baby name book when I was about 14.
Ah, yes, yes.
Fortunately, instead of freaking out, she just got me one and knew what it was for. So I do think about it a lot.
I wish that we had a lot more time, Rebecca, because there's other areas that your book touches on. For instance, governmental indifference, a broken healthcare system. Oh, and survivor's
yeah.
guilt. There's so many areas here which I think are so relevant today, which is why I have to ask you about your book now, right here at this particular point in time, with what is going on in our world, particularly here in America. It does seem
right.
to me that we've gone into sort of, and I don't want to get off on a sort of a political thing here, but...
Oh, we can.
But it does seem like all of a sudden we're like, things have regressed in a lot of respects. And the way we think, yeah.
No, this is a time when, you know, there are 1.1 million Americans living with HIV and 37 million living with HIV globally, and a million people dying of AIDS globally a year. And, you know, the end of 2017, Trump goes and fires all the remaining members of the HIV/AIDS Advisory Council.
Yeah.
That budget, I don't know that we'll ever know what was in that budget. It was written on napkins, but it proposed cutting $1 billion in AIDS spending globally, which they're estimating will result in at least 1 million preventable deaths. And this is the same indifference. It's the same demographically based indifference towards marginalized people that killed, you know, the 35 million people who have died worldwide
yes.
since the start of AIDS, that killed people in the most developed country in the world. People were, it was just a mass murder of neglect. And we tend to think of this in the past tense. And we would tend, you know, I think a lot of people think that we've solved this problem and that we've learned something from it. And then, you know, here we go again. And when it's not this, it's going to be something else. It's some other group that is marginalized that's going to be denied access to healthcare. I mean, that's all, you know, constantly happening.
Yes.
But this kind of crisis is going to happen again. Absolutely. And it is most likely to hit marginalized communities first. And those are the communities that the people with power, the people with money are going to deny healthcare to.
We have been talking to Rebecca Mackay. The book is called The Great Believers. It really is a fabulous read. Rebecca, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Can I be honest with you? The Great Believers was a very difficult book to get through. And it truly did bring back a lot of memories of dear friends I lost during the early years of the AIDS crisis. But as I mentioned, I highly recommend the book. Well, it looks like we have a few moments left, and this is where I like to take the opportunity to bring you new music. First, a word about how you can hear my music show, niftily titled Life Elsewhere Music. All you need to do is to pop on over to Mixcloud or go to lifeelsewhere.co, and at both places, just look for Life Elsewhere Music. It's that easy. Okay, it's time to hear from Slippery Eyes. With, wait for it, Slippery Eyes. This is Life Elsewhere.
to see you.
That was Slippery Eyes with a track from their EP, Take Care, Be Well. The cuts we heard was Slippery Eyes, and Slippery Eyes are Kai on vocals and guitar, Cassie on bass, Christian on drums, and Jesse on guitar. And this is what they say about themselves. We are queer sad boy twinkles from Portland. Well, no reason to argue with that. Make sure you let me know what you think of the music and interviews. My email address is info@lifeelsewhere.co. Till next time, please be well and please be good. And it won't cost you a thing. Please be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.